You are listening to Your Pod and Your Staff, the podcast of College Life Christian Fellowship at UC Davis. I am Peter Nittler, the college pastor of First Baptist Church in Davis, California. And our mission is to shape college-age people from all spiritual starting points into complete and equipped agents of King Jesus. And on this podcast, we want to have conversations that will form you, encourage you, maybe even make you laugh, and we hope that they would be a source of King Jesus guiding you through this time. So, we're about to talk about some stuff that people feel pretty strongly about. But before we do, I want you to imagine this. I want you to imagine Jesus Christ during his ministry years and the 12 people around him, his disciples. Who was in that group? How similar was that group? Now, we might think it pretty common if you're a leader to have a pretty homogenous group of like-minded people around you, but that's far from the group that Jesus formed. On one side, there was Levi, a tax collector. He was an Israelite who turned to become the local arm of the Roman government, the oppressors. His politics was clear. I'm on Rome's side. And on the other side was Simon the Zealot. He's an Israelite so angry about Roman oppression, so set on removing them, he's more than willing to get violent. His politics is clear. He will never be on Rome's side. And he wants to hurt anyone who is. These are two people on radically different sides of the aisle. This is not like your moderate left cousin getting along with your moderate right uncle. These Venn diagrams do not overlap. These people are enemies in almost every way and in almost every context, but around Jesus and in the kingdom, they're brothers. So keep this image in your mind as we embark on this conversation, which is, yes, about politics. And if we're willing to explore it enough to imitate it, it might just show us how we are to follow in Jesus's footsteps. Now, Stanford Gibson does much of the heavy lifting in this conversation, and Miriam Hamilton and I just could not wait to listen and ask questions. And maybe you'll have some questions of your own. And if you do, email those questions and any other question that you might have about life, faith, the scriptures, marriage, Stanford, Miriam, email those to me at pnittler@fbcdavis.org. And in a few weeks, we'll do an episode answering a ton of your questions. But for now, this conversation might thrill you, it might frustrate you, it might puzzle you, but in all of it, remember that we follow a man who brings enemies together and makes them brothers. It's time for the podcast. I hope you enjoy. Welcome back, all my friends, to Your Pod and Your Staff. We are back together with Miriam and Stanford. Would you like to say hello to friends of mine?
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Let me ask you this. Have you guys taken, do you know what you are on the Enneagram?
Yeah.
Stanford?
I am embarrassed to say no.
I bet what is happening right now is people who have a thought of what you are probably like, oh, that's classic six, to not even know what you are.
Yeah, I'm definitely a 32.
I feel like every personality test I ever take, it's like StrengthsFinders, Myers-Briggs, Enneagram, everything coalesces around similar stuff. It's like there's high relational care. You know, everything that comes to a conclusion of like, Peter seems to care more about the feel of the room than he does about the decisions being made in a meeting. Like that kind of thing. You know, cares more about how people are feeling than about getting his way.
Which, like, when you're reading it, it probably just sounds like they're trying to put a soft spin on, he doesn't know what he's doing, but at least he cares about people. Yeah.
This is what weak people tell themselves that feel like being weak is actually strong. But I tell you that because it does align. Like, I think it's true. I think that I am what you would call a people pleaser. I care sometimes a lot about how people are feeling around me, feel very aware of if someone's upset in the room or if I've made them upset. Or if someone were to say, hey, Peter, what do you want for food? I'm definitely thinking, what do you want me to want to go get for food? Mm-hmm. That's how I've made decisions throughout my whole life. So that's definitely me. And so I've been a little bit nervous about the conversation we're about to have. I've been biting my nails a little bit all day because the ground we're about to embark on, the pool that we're diving into from the high dive, is not something that people feel softly about. It feels like people either don't care or people care way a lot, and it could make people pretty upset. And so it's like, that's just not a pool I generally swim in, is the making people upset pool. So I feel a little bit nervous, but also really, really excited, because I think what we have to say hopefully cuts through a lot of what might be making people angry. But we're talking about politics in this episode, the theology of politics. So not a left-right kind of deal, but just how should we be thinking about this stuff and what wisdom is there from the scriptures? And, you know, Stanford, you've wanted to do a talk about this kind of thing for a while, and not necessarily out of a, hey, I really want to speak to the politics of the moment, but actually because you've read the prophets and you've noticed some stuff in the prophets, particularly I think Isaiah and Jeremiah. And because of that, you feel like we really need to talk about this. And so you were going to have this as one of your talks. And, you know, we said last week that we were going to take one of your pitches and extend it out to a further conversation. And so that's what we're going to do, is that you saw this thing in the scriptures and really wanted to tease it out and see what it means for the moment. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about what you saw in the scriptures?
Yeah, I certainly didn't go into our study of the Hebrew scriptures thinking, oh, I definitely want to talk about politics and we're going to wedge it in there somewhere. I agree. It's not something I really enjoy talking about. College lifers who have come to Lunch Bunch have probably noticed I'm super cagey about it and am very reticent to talk about politics for reasons that I think will become apparent. But there are these stories in the Hebrew scriptures that are like right side by side that I think are just so sublimely curious. And so let me pitch them to you.
Yeah.
So Isaiah and Jeremiah, they're two of the major prophets. And by that, we just mean
big books.
Yeah, they're long, right? And so Isaiah comes first, Jeremiah comes second. If you remember our mental map, let me just frame this for you very quickly. There is an exile. Basically, the people of God are taken from the land by these growing hegemonic superpowers that come out of the east. And when we say there's an exile, there's actually two. The northern kingdom, Israel, gets exiled by Assyria. And then the southern kingdom, many years later, gets exiled by Babylon. Isaiah is prophesying before that first exile. And so the way that this goes down is Assyria is honestly the biggest, baddest superpower the world has ever seen. They develop these siege works. They're brutal. And they're just wiping through civilization. No one can stand up to them. And so Hezekiah, who's the king at the time, is terrified. Everyone's terrified. It is bigger than a pandemic. It is an existential threat, and it's bearing down on Israel, and particularly Judah and Jerusalem, and Hezekiah's the king. And Hezekiah's like, what do I do? And Isaiah says, you're going to stand strong, you're going to resist, and God is going to deliver you. To deliver us, if we put our faith in Yahweh, you do not need to be afraid. You will be able to stand up to this global superpower, which sounds absurd. Now, for those of you who were there in the winter when we talked about this, what happens is this is actually recorded in the annals of the Assyrian king. And the Assyrian king actually goes through and wipes through every civilization, but actually gets to Hezekiah and claims that he did not actually defeat Hezekiah. And in the scriptures, Hezekiah and the people of Judah and Jerusalem stand up to the Assyrian empire and win. God intervenes and they do not get wiped out.
So I imagine that Judah's army, the southern kingdom, is probably not immense, massive, huge. And then we're having the Assyrians, which is like as big as you can imagine. Like if you were to think, I mean, maybe I just watched Lord of the Rings, the freaking orcs and the Uruk-hai are just like marching on. And it's like, how can a little military stand up to that? No one can stand up to it. And yet we see Hezekiah and the Jerusalem army basically stand up.
They stand up, but they don't actually battle. If the angel of the Lord comes, there's some speculation in other literature that there was some sort of plague or something like that. But the fact that is both in the scriptures and in the Assyrian literature is that the Assyrians do not take Jerusalem. Jerusalem survives. Everyone else is exiled, but Jerusalem remains this little pocket of unexiled, you know, cultural survival.
And so that seems like an actual fact. Like, it's not like, oh, this is a fun story that the scriptures tell, but it is in the Assyrian literature. So it's like, this happened.
Right.
The explanation, it can be up for grabs, but this happened.
Right. You're not used to thinking about politics as, do you stand up to the Assyrian hegemon, right? Like, that's not the sort of political decision we're making. The candidates that we're going to vote on, they're not going to say, and my position on the Assyrian hegemon is that we should stand and fight, right? But it was the political decision of the day. And so the Yahwehist position on that would be stand and fight. God will deliver you. Mm-hmm. Okay. So fast forward several decades. And now the big bad hegemon is Babylon. Babylon is bigger and badder than Assyria. They take Assyria's siege methods and they refine them. They make them stronger. They make them more brutal. And they wipe out Assyria and then come and basically do the same thing Assyria did. They wipe out everyone else. And now they're bearing down on Israel. And the king of Israel at the time says, hey, last time this happened, God delivered us. We're going to stand up and fight. Mm-hmm. And Jeremiah is the prophet of God and says, no, don't do that.
Wow.
God is not with you. You have two choices. You can surrender or you can run away. You should under no circumstances try to stand and fight against Babylon. And of course, they do stand and fight and they get wiped out. And so...
Was there a big difference in the culture of the kingdom at the time of Isaiah and at the time of Jeremiah that seemed to maybe be influencing this? Or were they kind of in similar places of disobedience?
Yeah, in the time of Isaiah, you know, the northern kingdom was a wreck and God was just done with the northern kingdom and was going to exile them. The southern kingdom under Hezekiah and, you know, before that under Uzziah, they're actually in a little bit of what I would call a moral golden age. There are a couple of bad apples in there, but the Uzziah Hezekiah period is actually a period of stability, prosperity. There's some undercurrents of disobedience, but it's actually a pretty good time. And so there's a sense in which you could look at this story and say, yeah, that God is done with the northern kingdom, but has some hope for the southern kingdom. But by the time we get to Jeremiah, the southern kingdom has just completely gone sideways. And we've had just a string of horrific leadership, and the people have pretty much completely departed from the worship of Yahweh. And so God says, it's the southern kingdom's time. You're going into exile. The whole book of Jeremiah is that, hey, you're going to exile, and that's going to be a time of, it's going to be a time of, honestly, judgment, but also of growth and restoration, and that I will bring you back. Now it's not the time to stand and fight because I'm not with you. Okay, those are a couple of obscure ancient Near Eastern stories about a minor vassal state standing up to a global hegemon. What does that have to do with American politics? I think everything. And here's why.
Yes, let's do it.
What you have is two identical political situations. The people of God are facing a conquering hegemonic power. And in one era, the Yahwehist position was stand and fight. And in another era, the Yahwehist position was surrender or run away. And so here's what I believe about how the ethics of the Old Testament influence our politics, is that the moral assertions of the scriptures are timeless, right? That's kind of fundamental to what we believe, that, you know, culture changes and the way we interact with each other changes and technology changes. But there's something fundamental about being a human, and there are things about being a human that were right and will be right and were wrong and will be wrong, and that these moral assertions of the scriptures are timeless, but they actually do play out situationally. They actually do have different instantiations in different political realities. And so that has some pretty significant implications on what it means to be a Christian who has a political conscience and is active politically.
It seems to challenge our belief that there's one way to engage politically, and most notably that as Christians, if we read scripture, we're going to find that way. Like, if you interpret scripture correctly, then you're going to find the way to be an American citizen and engage politically. But that maybe there's kind of more space for different interpretations.
Yeah, I think that's right. So this leads me to the thing that I read, you know, a couple decades ago that influenced my political theology the most. And that is a piece by C.S. Lewis, where C.S. Lewis argued that it was impossible to have a Christian political party. He said Christians are united on the things that we value. You know, we value justice, we value truth, we value joy, we value integrity, we value all sorts of things that are themes of the Hebrew scriptures. But we will disagree on the tactics that implies. And so we all value justice, righteousness, and integrity. But what does that mean for a marginal tax rate? Mm-hmm. You know, does that mean the marginal tax rate should be 32% or 22? Or is the marginal tax rate more important than the capital gains tax rate? Like, those questions fall in the range of tactics. And tactics are issues of conscience for individual Christians. And so we can all agree on the fundamental moral principles that the scriptures are timeless, but how those instantiate into a particular time and place. What I believe about maybe the marginal tax rate right now, it could actually be different than what was wise 20 years ago or what would be wise 20 years from now.
Okay, so basically what you saw in Jeremiah and Isaiah, and then what you read from C.S. Lewis of there sort of not being a Christian party. Let me see if I can see how these ideas coalesce. So it's like both Isaiah and Jeremiah are dealing with a time where this small nation is about to be overrun by the orcs. And in one situation, Isaiah says the response that Israel should have is stand and resist, and God will protect you. And very similar scenario comes up, and Jeremiah does not give the same response. So that leads us to believe that the response that people who follow Yahweh should have is not just going to be a plug and play, the same thing every time. That there's these certain values that in different seasons are going to manifest themselves in different ways. And so because of sort of that principle, that truth, there's never going to be something like a Christian party, because to have a Christian party with like set platforms does not follow that logic of how ethics is done.
And I think the answer here is that politics is just really hard. I almost always feel unqualified to vote. Economics is really hard, and I do not understand it well enough to confidently decide generally, particularly on local levels, who's got the best platform. Right. I'm using heuristics and surrogates to try to figure that stuff out, but I don't know if they're right. Mm-hmm. And so politics is really hard, and what tactics are actually going to lead to my values mm-hmm. is very difficult to determine. And so if I have a brother or sister who sees that differently and thinks that another set of tactics will lead to my values, I need to give them like a boatload of grace, because this is actually a really difficult thing to do.
Yeah, I think my question with all of this is like, how do you even go about discerning the best strategy to get to your values? I have struggled because I have been a part of faith communities that have predominantly aligned with different political parties, and these communities all espouse the same values, but they seem to have these contradictory views of how to get there. And so for me, as I've been like developing my own political ideology, I feel this like overload of self-skepticism, because I can see these communities that I love and trust going about it in completely different ways. And so that leaves me with the question of, how do you even go about figuring out what you think is the best tactic or strategy?
Well, I actually think that's one of the places where I just love being in the church, right? Because the church is one of the only places you can be where people who love each other think very different politically, right? Where you can really be sitting next to two people who think totally differently. And that makes it harder for us in a good way, because we can never be like, oh, everyone believes this. We know there are people we love and trust. There are people I love and trust who are smarter than me that vote both to the left and to the right. And so it makes me skeptical of my own positions, which I just think is the most helpful thing. You know, of all of the Christian disciplines that I've found helpful in my life, not just politically, but just like in marriage and at work, is self-skepticism, is not believing my own thoughts too easily. And so I just think the fact that you're running into self-skepticism because you're embedded in these diverse communities is just a wonderful like fringe benefit of being in the church. But I'd also say that one of the interesting things is that so far we've been talking about how values Christians hold are kind of the same across the board. But I've been kind of cheeky about that, because is that really true?
Yeah.
And I think that one of the interesting things about the Hebrew scriptures, and in fact, when we did the pitch meeting, I pitched these as two different talks. And at one point, Peter, I think you said, I think those are the same idea, mm-hmm. is that one of the things you notice in the Hebrew scriptures is the Hebrew scriptures don't use the word good and bad like we do. Like yeah. we generally think, is something good? Are you a good person? Or is something bad? Are you a bad person?
Right.
And a lot of times, kind of in the milieu that we're in, whether or not you're a good person or a bad person has to do with, do you vote the way I do?
Yeah, totally. And it's like, and these people are mine and these people are good people, and people who don't vote like me are bad people.
And that just offends me so deeply, because there's nothing that costs me less than voting. Right. I think that virtue has to do with what's costly. It can't be virtuous if it only costs you 3 minutes to take a left on your way home and pull a ballot or like put a stamp on something and mailing it. There's nothing less costly than voting. It can't be the source of your virtue. Now, don't get me wrong. I vote. I bring my children. I teach them to vote. But part of the problem is that kind of this very simplistic good, bad, are you with me or are you against me politically idea, it's really very foreign to the Hebrew scriptures. The Hebrew scriptures have this very complex taxonomy of aspects of goodness, right? The Hebrew scriptures use words like integrity, righteousness, holiness, justice, faithfulness. And if you kind of listen to those words, some of those are kind of conservative words and some of those are kind of liberal words, right?
Oh, that's good.
Some of those really have a lot to do with like personal ethics, personal integrity, like yeah. how I live my life, things that would include like truth-telling and sexual ethics and, you know, how I treat my children, like things that are me and mine. But some of those are very like communal and have to do not only with how we treat other people in groups, but how we treat other people in out-groups. Mm-hmm. And so one of the amazing things that I noticed in this read through the scriptures, you know, as I read through the prophets to prepare for these talks that we're not doing, one of the things that struck me is how many times the prophets use justice and righteousness in the same sentence or couplet. All right, yeah. Let me read a couple of these to you. Proverbs 1:3, he's stating the thesis of the book. He says, this is why this book exists. This is what I'm trying to do here. And the teacher says, I'm giving you this book so that you can receive instruction in wise dealing in righteousness, justice, and equity. And then Proverbs 2:7 says, Yahweh stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to those who walk in integrity, guarding the paths of justice. And then Jeremiah, God says, I am Yahweh who practices steadfast love, justice, and righteousness in the earth, for in these things I delight. And then Isaiah 23:5, this is the righteous branch passage we talked about last week. Listen to how he describes the righteous branch. He says, behold, the days are coming, declares Yahweh, when I raise up for David a righteous branch, and he shall reign as king and deal wisely and shall execute justice and righteousness. And it goes on. I have a list. I'll stop there. But the idea is that I think that a lot of my liberal friends think of God as a God of justice. I think a lot of my conservative friends think of God as a God of righteousness. And you know what? Neither of them are wrong. Unless.
That's good. Yeah.
They only do that.
So it seems like the picture we're painting is to think sort of like theology of politics that you would get from the scriptures. If it were to enter in and be able to sort of like speak to American politics, like if someone who is well read on all the scriptures comes to town and is going to give a little TED talk, hey, I'm going to teach you how to think about politics in America. Probably one thing they would say is you guys have split yourself up in this left-right thing and you both are claiming Christianity on your side. And what I'm coming to tell you is that neither of you get all this. The worldview that you espouse is bigger than the tenets of these two parties. How does that sound?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there are emphases on, you know, personal responsibility and personal righteousness and, you know, things that, you know, truth-telling, sexual ethics, things like that, that we would kind of put in this conservative bucket, this righteousness bucket. And then there's issues of, you know, of systemic oppression, which the Old Testament prophets are really concerned about systemic oppression. Like, that's one of their big deals. Yeah. And how we treat the poor, the powerless, these are big themes in the prophets. These are issues that weigh very heavily on the hearts of my more liberal friends. And I think that kind of the good news here is that that's all right. But
yeah,
we don't actually get to choose one or the other.
It's amazing to me how it is true. Like if you were to sort of put your liberal glasses on and read through the scriptures, you would find so much that feels like, see,
that's right.
This is that's what I'm saying. And if you put your conservative glasses on, you read the scriptures, you would say, see, this is what I'm saying. Like, I am always amazed by the year of Jubilee, the principle that every once in a while, literally all debts are paid, all, you know, servants are released. Like, there's just like this, there couldn't be any more of a liberal sort of like idea, I guess. You know, it just seems so idealistic. And then there's also such care to say, hey, what you do matters. And you kind of have to own up to some of these things and how we behave matters. And there are limits and there's boundaries to what you could do and to who you can be. And you can think like, yeah, see, like righteousness really is like really important. It's really crucial what we do. And so you can just really come to the conclusion, if you're seeing it the way you're choosing to, that the scriptures are on your side and they're against the other side.
Right.
So how do we engage with this idea of both righteousness and justice, given the political framework that we have right now? Because I could sort of see this argument of like, well, you are really limited as a human and you're limited too in your choices of political party in America, where you don't really have the option, it seems to me, to put a lot of energy and to put your support behind both righteousness and justice. Is there a way to sort of reconcile that given the framework that we're working with here?
Vote for Ralph Nader. My favorite bumper sticker of all time, by the way, I was playing flag football. I was teensy tiny and I had no idea who these people were, I don't think. But it was the Al Gore, George Bush election, and it was a Ralph Nader bumper sticker, and it said, Bush and Gore make me Ralph. It was awesome. Anyway, that's not a real answer.
I don't know if I should respond to that.
You don't have to.
But the invitation's open.
Yeah, walk through that door if you want.
Well, I think there are a couple of options. I think the first option is apathy. I think that's an option that a lot of Christians choose, is just like, neither of these teams are my team. I just hate voting. It doesn't matter which box I check. I leave the polling place physically ill. Like, I just feel physically ill because I know that I've made this decision that I don't have enough economics background to actually evaluate. I'm relying on surrogates. that this thing that I've done, this box that I've checked, has the better tactics that go behind what I think is these robust, you know, very complex, diverse, beautiful values. I'm not sure. And maybe it just doesn't matter that much. I'm always a little bit concerned when apathy is the answer. I'm not really sure that's great advice. But I do feel like that's where a lot of us retreat to. And I can tell you, you know, it might sound at this point that I am apathetic about politics. The truth is I have very strong political opinions and I vote pretty consistently. I refuse to allow it to possess my identity capital. It is not who I am. How I vote is not who I am. And I will do my very best job, but in the end, I will recognize that I'm like 1/100 millionth of this decision. And I'm going to give that the intellectual and emotional effort that I think that it deserves. I'm going to do my very best job to make the decision that I think I should make. But then I'm not going to allow it to define my identity, and I'm not going to allow it to define my life agenda.
Mm. Yeah, what you're saying seems so obvious, like maybe there's a middle ground between apathy and complete identification with a particular way that you vote. It seems so obvious, but it's also so far from how we actually engage politically.
Yeah, I think what makes it hard right now is that to have a value of anything means that inherently when that's not present, you're upset. You know, if I value time with Mason and I am pulled away over and over and over and over and over again, it's my value of valuing time with Mason that will make me disappointed in that. And I think maybe, Stanford, what I'm hearing you saying a little bit is like, yes, eventually I will vote for one of these things, but I am going to resist the urge to make that my identity. I'm going to resist the urge of saying that's who I am. You're taking a broader look of who you are. You are a child of God. You are a, you know, Yahweh worshiper. That's who you are. You're not a liberal or a conservative. But I think what makes it really hard is that it feels like what is defining us right now is not just what we espouse, but also what we hate, you know, the things that we are outraged by. So if you're not outraged by the right things, then you don't care enough, or you're naive, or you're part of the problem. It seems like there's an incentive to hate and there's an incentive to be angry. If that's true, that's a highway to in-group, out-group thinking of I'm going to double down on what I think and also double down on not liking what they think. And I remember reading from Richard Mao, who was the president of Fuller for a while, and he talked a lot about, wrote a lot about civility. And he has this phrase, I don't know if it's original to him, convicted civility. We think we can have conviction or we think we can be civil. If you have conviction, then you have to be sort of all in, guns blazing approach, sort of screw everyone who doesn't think what I think. And if you're civil, you don't have an opinion. You just kind of let everything happen to you and you become a little doormat. And what he's saying is like, no, we need to marry these two things of having deep convictions about things, about what we think, how the world should look, about there being righteousness and justice, but we have to do it with civility. Like that is actually a value that Christians have. It's not like, hey, we have all these values. Now we have to think about how to do it civilly. It's actually one of our values is civility. So I feel like that's sort of what I'm after is how do we actually enact convicted civility? Because it feels like, oh, that's a really good idea. Yeah, why don't you go ahead and marry the two things? Even how to do that in general, but how to do that now seems really hard. If you were to lean on the side of civility, you're weak. And if you're to lean on the side of conviction, that seems like that's where everyone is. Everyone who cares is just convicted with not a lot of civility. So it just seems hard. And I don't know if there's a question there, but it just seems hard.
But I think a lot of political ideology is based out of what you fear. It, you know, it is also based out of what's the outgroup that you don't like, what you think is not cool even. But there's also a lot of what you fear. And I think that, you know, if you were to ask someone on the right, what do they fear? Like a hard version would be, well, we fear tyranny. And a softer version might be, we fear socialism. Where if you were to ask someone on the left what they fear, you know, a hard version might be we fear fascism. And a softer version is, you know, we fear the concentration of resources into a kind of vast exploitation. You know, what do I fear? I fear all of those things. None of those things sound great. I don't want any of those things. But you know what I fear more than any of those things, particularly for our students? Idolatry. And I think that that is what is happening. And so I'm just much more interested in where are we getting our identity capital from? And I think that if we are not getting our identity capital from our political party.
Can you just say like real fast, like what, like identity capital, what do you mean?
Well, when you think about what are the things that give you value, what are the things that make you like you and who you are? And if someone's to ask you, you know, what are the like top four things about you? You might not lead with your political party, but if you were honest, you might. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the more of our identity is tied to our political party, the harder it is for us to hypothesize that the other side might have value. You know, having your identity tied up in an ideology, I mean, it's almost a straight definition for idolatry.
Yeah.
So one of the tests that I have for, am I getting co-opted idolatrously by a political party is, does the political party have positions that I reject? You know, if you are accepting all the positions of your political party or most of them without resistance, then you've probably traded a Christian worldview that values integrity, justice, righteousness, holiness as this kind of wide, beautiful, diverse swath of the good for a checklist of one side of the American political system.
Hmm. What do you think is your read on why that's so easy to do? Is the Christian worldview that does want to marry things that sort of in our political system are on opposite sides of the aisle, is so hard to do? It's so much more cognitively simple to just pick a lane, mm-hmm. adopt that. Do you feel like if you were to kind of paint the story of why this is so tempting, would that be part of the story? That it's just cognitively easier to focus on one side of the coin, that sort of the Christian worldview demands we care about both? Sure, heads and tails are important, but you know, heads is there 50% of the time, and it's important to care about that 50%. And so I'm just going to do that.
Well, I think there's also a lot of social cost. Because yeah. one of the things that I find is that my liberal friends think I'm a conservative and my conservative mm-hmm. friends think I'm a liberal, because there are aspects of either worldview that I find objectionable and aspects of either worldview I find beautiful. And so if I'm not on the party line, then I must be part of the outgroup. I think that there's a social cost to that, because that means that my liberal friends think I'm evil and my conservative friends think I'm evil, if moral categories are people who are with me are good and people who are against me are evil. Like, I don't have anyone who thinks I'm good, because I resist certain parts of both of their worldviews. I think that that social cost is getting harder as the internet really polarizes and makes these criteria the criteria of moral evaluation. And I just think that we need to have our criteria of moral evaluation being like, what does God love? That is going to be a very freeing thing. Because the truth is, the internet will not love you. The left is moving farther left, the right is moving farther right, and you're always going to find people on your right and your left. And the internet will not love you, and it will not form a good basis for, you know, moral value or moral tactics. And so I think that really immersing yourself in the Christian theology of justice, righteousness, integrity, and making the best wise decisions you can make out of that, and then maybe not focusing so much on national politics, is really the wise way forward.
What's interesting about that question, Stanford, about what does God love, is that it seems like that could be used either to sort of tame our overly committed spirits to one political party, or it could be used as just like a power move. Like, if you're wholly committed to one political party and there's no flexibility in your thinking as to whether or not you're going to agree or disagree on certain issues, then that question of what does God love, if it's influencing the way that you view politics, is used as like a sort of confirmation bias. The answer to that question always aligns with the Republican Party or whatever. But if you have sort of a looser grip on your political party, then that question becomes freeing and could also open the door for more humility and evaluating, like, okay, what is the best tactic to get to these values that we as Christians all together believe? And could leave room for you to adjust your thinking and to come to a different conclusion and look back on yourself and think, hey, maybe I was actually wrong about that. And maybe they did have the right perspective on that and I could learn something from them. That picture seems so foreign to me because I so rarely see it. And also has created in me this sort of like embarrassment. Like, if I think something differently now than I did a year ago, then I just think, oh, I was so naive and so stupid back then. Instead of, oh, no, I'm just like a growing person who's learning to understand the world in different ways and gaining perspective because I'm getting older.
Yeah. And I'm old enough that I've come full circle on things. There are things that I used to believe naively that then I rejected, and then I rejected them and got back to the original. And sometimes I've gone through that cycle a couple of times. Sometimes I've gone through that cycle a couple of times in one Twitter thread.
I, uh, I sort of want to almost like put you guys on the spot a little bit to like diagnose me. And I don't know if it'll work, but I've noticed in myself that I shut down in conversation when I sense a very convicted conservative or liberal. And I'll tell you like the thought process that goes on in my head. And it's like, it's funny because it's like certain words or certain phrases that trigger me. And I have a lot of confidence in myself that I'm able to discern, and maybe I'm wrong, but it's like, there's certain phrases that it's like, oh, I recognize that from the rhetoric. I know that you are very much on the right or you are very much on the left. And then I put on that person all of those tenets, whether it's the right tenets or the left tenets. And I assume this is the way you see the world. And everything is based on these convictions that you have. The values you have, what you think about ethics, everything is based on this way that you've been formed. And so I kind of think, okay, well, then we can't actually have an actual conversation because we would have to lay out our assumptions. We would have to really commit to we're going to have grace for each other. And it's just like in a passing conversation, like we're not going to spend the time doing that. So I get into people-pleasing mode where I'm just like, okay, I can't actually really be a person in this conversation. I'm just going to kind of nod along to what I can nod along to and maybe pose a few questions that make me feel better about not just kind of diving into one ideology or the other. But I really feel myself shut down. I really feel like I would just much rather not than engage. And so I guess I fear in that. Like I do think about, you know, like people like Martin Luther King, who felt very strongly about things politically, and a lot of good came from that, you know, and stood up to a lot of evil because of that. And I sometimes have this like vision of someone like that talking to me. It's like, Peter, if you're not willing to engage, you just don't care. You know, you are way too quote unquote civil. If we were to use that convicted civility metric from before, you're way too civil. You have to engage in these things. You have to stand up for truth. You have to stand up for what's right. But I definitely feel myself back down when I engage in conversation with people that I sense, like I said, are way on the right or way on the left. And I am struggling with what does it mean to care? Because I guess I feel myself tend to go to apathy because I'm so afraid of going too far in the convicted sense. Mm-hmm. And something that you said, Stanford, about national politics made me think, I wonder if that is an answer to the thing that I am struggling with, of like, there feels like no tenable solution to caring. This could be wrong. But I think both the word politics, if it's centered around the polis, and then I think civility is, I don't know, civilitas or something like that, is also something from city. You know, and so it's like maybe the scale to which these conversations are happening actually does not allow us to live faithfully as not one side or the other. But I wonder if we were to change our scope, so scale down from the national politics, which you've sort of identified, we have very little control over, even though it's important to exercise that control. Then think about, okay, well, what are the things that we have a little bit more influence on, affect the people that we're seeing on the day to day? It's like maybe that we were never supposed to think that we should care about politics as a national thing. But if built into the word is the city idea, it's like, is there something there where it's like, that could be a way forward where we can live more into a convicted civility? I feel like I asked that question about 7 times in that, in me asking that question. But
yeah, it's because I think you have about 7 answers embedded in that question. And I think that you're getting to some of the really helpful stuff. Maybe we should take a intermission, because we want to transition to maybe some more practical ideas. Is this a good time for intermission?
Yeah, a good time for intermission. We have an idea about what we want to do for an intermission, because as we're having this podcast right now, people are knocking on my doors. People are texting me. We want to hear Miriam's poem. We've been waiting a week to hear Miriam's poem. And so Miriam, would you like to share your email poem and maybe catch people up who are not remembering from last week's Quarantine Corner?
I would love to. So my Quarantine Corner last week was that everyone should become a poet. I had a friend of mine who she texted me this poem that somebody had written that was composed entirely of the subject line or the first lines of emails she's received while being in quarantine. My friend challenged me to write my own. So please have grace for me. This took all of 5 minutes to write. So
you're a poet.
This is untitled. By Miriam Hamilton. If you're not sure what day it is, you're not alone. How to prepare now for your post-pandemic job search. Since many of us are working from home and drinking more coffee, 6 tips for nannies and sitters who've been let go during coronavirus. If you're not sure what day it is, you're not alone. We're here to help you through the coronavirus situation. Spokane County Library District has closed all library locations to the public. We're covering the state of coronavirus testing in the U.S. If you're not sure what day it is, you're not alone. Vulnerability connects us during these times, but so does strength. 25% off, plus an additional 10% off for medical, grocery, and first responders. As you know, widespread testing for coronavirus is critical for us to get this disease under control. If you're not sure what day it is, you're not alone. Over the last couple months, the coronavirus pandemic has disrupted our entire world. The local native show at McMiniman's on May 23rd has been canceled. You have tested negative for COVID-19.
Nice. I like embedded in that is the we're here for you in this crisis, which I've gotten an email of that sort from like Walmart and I don't know, like
CBS.
Yolo County Library, CBS, everything I've ever given my information to. They're all here for
right.
me.
I do have to tell you, I tried to write a poem and it was something like, please hand in your timesheet. Please hand in your timesheet now. You have mandatory training.
That's awesome.
This project is overdue. It read a lot like my poem would have read
right.
before COVID. All right, so Peter had a 7-part question. Okay, so let me see if I can summarize my theological premise about how I've thought about politics, is that the Christian scriptures are cross-pressured. The demands that the Hebrew and Christian scriptures make of us are for integrity and justice and righteousness and things that really transcend the categories that the individual parties have. And how that plays out in tactics is going to be a matter of conscience and honestly a matter of like economic analysis that's going to differ from even like PhD economist to PhD economist. And so my primary concern is that we are being primarily formed by these political parties and our sense of moral good and moral evil is being formed by these ideologies. Neither of them really have the whole picture. And so then what do we do? Like, how do we move forward as I feel like the volume of politics is increasing? You know, how do we move forward? Because also apathy just never seems like a good choice, right? Like just being like, okay, let's just check out here. That just never seems like a good choice. But I think that there is a premise built into the idea that if you are not deeply engaged in national politics, then you're part of the problem. And that is that if there's a problem in the world, the primary way to deal with the problem in the world is to exert power. Because politics is primarily about power. It's about who gets power and who wields power and what they do with that power. And I just think that in general, Christians are very bad at wielding power because it's not our mandate. Yeah. Our mandate is self-giving love. Our mandate is to spend ourselves on behalf of others. And so it just seems like whenever Christians get and wield power, it always has a poison pill in it of some sort. And so I can tell you that, you know, I do vote on the national level, me and 126 million of my closest friends, right? Like voted in the national election. And I can tell you that even though I try not to let it weigh on me, the amount of effort and emotional equity that I spent on that vote was not proportionate to the value of that act. And so I think that one of the insights that you need to have in life is that one of the surest paths to misery is to care deeply about something you can't influence. And so I think that part of this like deep anxiety that is running through our culture on both sides of the political spectrum right now is that people are hugely invested in something that they have very little power in. And so there are basically, I think, two ways to approach that. And one is to, you know, you vote with your best conscience, but then disentangle yourself emotionally from it. Don't let it swerve into idolatry. Do your political duty, but then get your identity capital from being a child of God, being embedded in a loving community, and also like doing acts of self-giving service. And I think that the second idea is that the smaller scale at which you're active politically, the more it matters and the more it starts to diverge from these party line ideologies. You'll find that local politics is actually much more diverse. And so the scale at which you can affect things, you can become politically engaged and actually make a difference. And if you believe deeply in one set of tactics as aligning with Christian values, you can really actually start to see those play out. And I do think that the model for Christian engagement in politics isn't the
Hebrew theocracy, you know, during the reign of David, it really is how the Hebrews were in exile. When they lived in Babylon, they were a religious minority. Babylon wasn't going to adopt the moral values of the Hebrews, right? The Hebrews were just trying to keep their own moral values. You would think that God's word to the Hebrews would be like, yeah, just cut off and just stay out of the way. You know, don't get wiped out, but also keep your head down and just kind of do your own thing. But in Jeremiah 29, listen to what God says to the Hebrews while they're an oppressed people in Babylon. He says, "And thus says the Lord of hosts, God of Israel, to all the exiles who I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon, build houses and live in them, plant in gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters, and take wives for your sons and give your daughters into marriage, that they may bear sons and daughters." There's that kind of generational theme that keeps coming up and up again that we talked about.
Yeah, there you go.
Multiply there and do not decrease. You know, get some of your identity capital from your family and the people you love and the people you care about and the people you invest in. And then this is the verse. It says, "But seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile and pray to Yahweh on its behalf. For its welfare, you will find your welfare." And so there is this sense in which this exiled minority community of God followers, they weren't told to disengage and not just to become this cloister group just taking care of themselves. God told them, you know, engage in the welfare of your city. Be part of it. You're not going to take it over. You're not going to wield power over it, but you will get to have positive influence.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about this when we were sort of brainstorming our loneliness series too. It's interesting because in that verse, there's also that bit about it will be good for you too. And the frustration of not being able to affect change and kind of putting your efforts towards national politics where you should put some effort, but when we're kind of disproportionately putting more effort there where we're not really affecting much change, just creates this frustration in us that engagement in our local communities and local politics seems to do the opposite of encouraging us and giving us some sense of purpose. And also what you were saying about how that just sort of makes more sense of the Christian mission to be people of self-giving love. And there's much more opportunity for that in like a local setting than in a national setting where you're really just dealing with where you're putting power.
And on a more local level, you're more likely to look your political opponent in the eye and know their children and see them as a person who also wants the good of the city, but sees a different tactical path to that good. And you're more likely to provide them empathy and maybe wonder if their path isn't better or could somehow mesh with the path that you see forward. And I just think that that's likely to produce a better outcome.
Maybe if we can practice that more frequently, then we'll just be better at disagreeing on a national level too. My hopeful brain is like tracking a trajectory of if we can start here at kind of grassroots more and learn how to disagree with our neighbors who we know, then we'll be better at disagreeing with people who we don't know and who it's much easier to blame and criticize and judge.
Yeah, it's funny. I think that as we've been talking, I'm recognizing in myself the thing that I'm most interested in this conversation. Like it's started to crystallize for me. And I think that it comes from this idea is like, I think that often my sense is that as Christians, we are afraid of the dangers of caring too much about things, like the dangers of caring too much about your studies, the dangers of caring too much about your girlfriend, the dangers of, I guess we're afraid of idolatry. Like, I think that often we are told like, hey, wait, pump the brakes. Don't care too much about that. You got to care about God, you know? And I've said this before in different contexts, but it feels like when we sort of adopt that mindset, we sense that maybe I care about this new relationship more than I care about God. And so what I'm going to do is it's hard to just care more about God. So I'm going to try to artificially decrease my care in this new relationship, you know? And I think also that about politics. Maybe what we're saying is that one of the temptations right now is that people are so finding their identity in their political identity. Like that's saying who they are. Those are the ethics and the values that are forming them. And what we are trying to say is like, whoa, that seems a little out of whack. You know, there's actually a bigger story that if you belong to God, like you actually have to affirm more than what that side of the aisle is affirming. And so we might be getting into that same dynamic that it seems like what you're doing is you're caring too much about the political identity and you're not caring as much about your spiritual identity. And so what sounds like what we're saying is just decrease your care in the political identity. It's a long-winded way of saying, I think what I'm interested in is in all those things, I think, no, Christians should not be people who do not care.
That's right.
Like we have a conviction about the world. We have beauty to share with the world. We have convictions that we should have. It's like, I do not think the right advice is, hey, don't care about your girlfriend. Like, care less about her. I think we should have an abundance of care. We should be people who just care very deeply. And so I think I'm realizing I'm interested in is like, how do we target our care? Because it seems like right now, if you target your care at the national political level, the options are agree with this and hate this, or agree with that and hate that, which it seems hard to maintain a robust sort of righteousness and justice paired together worldview if those are your options. And it seems like right now the system is just forming people into that image. But it seems like if you really want to care with the abundant way that it feels like Christians ought to care for things in the world, for people in the world, then maybe the way to do that is care about actual people in your city who are affected by things that you have something to do about. I'm realizing that that's what I am most interested in this conversation, because it feels so hard for me to know, how do I aim my care in a way that feels not idolatrous, but maintains a robustness of what I should be caring about in the Christian worldview?
So I'm going to say something kind of bombastic here, as if I haven't been saying bombastic things all along. But here's what I want to say to that. If you aren't interested in local and regional politics, you're probably not that interested in politics. If the only side of political theater that animates you is the drama that unfolds on the national stage as, you know, kind of my team is prevailing or not prevailing over the other team, then you basically are following sports. And you know what's more fun and less damaging? Following sports. Get yourself a sports team. Now, I think a diagnostic that politics is forming your identity capital, and you know, you're in it mainly for what it's doing for you rather than what you're doing for other people through it, is if you're only interested in the national stage. Because the national stage is really about tribal affinity. It's really about, you know, is my team prevailing? Do I belong to the right group? And how are we doing against our shared outgroup enemies? And that sort of thinking just simply couldn't be farther from the Christian ethic, where we're called to really love our enemies and think complexly about them and try to care for them.
So how would you encourage people to get involved in local politics? That seems like a really basic question, but also the way that I have been trained to engage in politics is almost entirely on the national level. So I'm curious as to what you have to say about the best ways to sort of start getting more engaged.
Well, it starts with not ignoring those parts of your ballot. Who's on your school board has a lot more to do with what's going on in actual communities proportionally with respect to your vote than who you check in the president or even the Senate box. You know, just getting involved in that part of your ballot. And again, not getting involved in it emotionally or idolatrously, but just like recognizing that if the ballot is an exertion of power, it's the down ballot stuff where you're actually exerting more power. But then I would just say, develop skills for the good of the city. Develop skills that you can invest in shared secular spaces. That was the mandate to the exiles in Babylon. You know, Babylon was not a righteous nation. Babylon was an oppressive hegemony, right? Like, and God called them to invest in its good. And you see in the book of Daniel, they also had influence for Yahweh's values once the nation saw that they were acting in its good.
You know, I still have this pretend conversation with Martin Luther King in my head. Like, I guess I still have the question of, when is it time to go all in? Like, when is it time to just say, no, I get that there's some danger of being idolatrous here, but we must stand up to this evil. You know, we must stand up to this. This is not okay on a national level, you know. And I'm thinking of, like, we have an alumni who's, I think, right now transitioning to get his PhD. He works a lot with addicted people and people dealing with homelessness and thinking a lot about incarceration rates, you know. And it's like, you say all those things, that's generally going to land on one side of the aisle. And he seems like he's in a position right now where he ought to be thinking about bigger things. But at the same time, he's investing in actual
That's
jails.
Right.
Like, he's investing in That's actual right. communities. He's investing in actual places that it's like, yeah, you can have these national ideologies, but it's like, there is a homeless community
That's
near
right.
you, or there is a jail near you. Maybe it's time to go all in for the things you care about all the time, especially as Christians. Again, we should have an abundance of care, but the all in that it would be is, where do you see this need closest to you now? And yeah, maybe there's some questions of like, hey, why think small? the world doesn't get changed by people who think small, but it's like, well, maybe start small, you know, and see if it leads you to somewhere bigger. You know, I even think of our friend Eric Dirksen, who does this, I think every Friday, for a community in Davis who don't know where their meals are coming from, you know, and it's like, that is maybe not changing the world. And it's maybe not anything about tax rates, and it's maybe not anything about city ordinances about homeless people, but it is something to bless, you know, and it is something to care for. And it's something that reflects an attitude of like, I'm going to go all in on the things that I value.
Let me just state one more time. I feel very strongly about my political positions. I think some of them are incredibly important. Now, incidentally,
what are they?
Some of the positions that I'm most passionate about are not represented by the same party, but I feel very passionate about them. But my concern is that because we evaluate ourselves morally based on our political positions, it's become a sort of placebo that we think that we're justified by politics, if you will, you know, that we think that if we align politically in a certain way, that almost like our job is done. And the real work of any project starts on the scale of local communities. I think that most people think about, you know, okay, voting is kind of the minimum political act, the minimum political work. So what else can you do in politics? Well, you can rant on the internet. Right. And that would be like, if voting is a B minus, then ranting on the internet, that's where you get the A. And I guess what I'm suggesting is that, you know, ranting on the internet maybe would get you the B, maybe it actually gets you a C minus because it alienates the folks that you're trying to convince. But the A is getting actively involved in the things you think are really important. And I think that student who I just adore, who, you know, he's getting his PhD, he thinks about the like national implications of homelessness and incarceration rates. And I think he's thinking about those in really, really profound ways, but is also like in the jails with particular inmates, is kind of the model of this. I wouldn't want to ask that student to care less, right? It's the national scale that's motivating his local behaviors. And I think that's remarkable. Like, I just think the issue of incarceration rates, which is something that really matters to me, is an example of how I've found engagement in local politics to be really useful. And by politics, I don't mean the exertion of power. I mean saying yes to jury duty. I got on a month-long jury that I could not afford to do professionally, but I was able to experience my county's criminal justice system. I was able to kind of evaluate it and decide, like, what direction do I want this to go the next time there's an election? You know, that's one of the beautiful things about our system, is that I got to actually like stand for what I believed was justice along with a community of my peers. And so I do think that there are always local opportunities to make sure that, you know, your political positions aren't some sort of moral placebo, but actually are motivating you to act in love out of, you know, these reservoirs of justice and righteousness that we see in the heart of Yahweh.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to leave it. I'm going to take a stab at just navigating where we have gone in this conversation and jump in if I'm missing anything, but I'm going to try to go based off of my memory. If we start with the premise that the values that the scriptures espouse do not get applied the same way all the time. And so that sort of principle leads us to believe that to be a faithful Christian is not always going to look like being always on the right or always on the left. And one danger of identifying that one is the Christian answer or the other is the Christian answer is that we are sort of in danger of just adopting that version of reality and truth and values and ethics as our own. And pretty soon, once we've gone down that direction, now it's actually not the way that God sees the world or the world that the scriptures espouse. That's actually not forming us anymore. Actually, it's the political party that's forming us. And that sort of creates a tension because it's like, okay, well, then do we just totally disengage? But we care about the world. And so we can't disengage. So how do we do it? Not that we're giving an answer, this is the way to do it. But in talking about it, we said, well, no, we are supposed to care. And apathy is not the way to go, even though it feels like sometimes the only option, but it's to care deeply, to vote with your conscience, and also to figure out where you can enter in with righteousness and justice on a local level, the street that you live on, the town that you live in, and to live out some of these values, not just with your vote for who's president. That's not how you live out your calling to follow Yahweh. But it's the way that you engage day-to-day, local level. And so sort of to answer my question, it isn't just conviction or civility. It is a convicted civility that cares deeply about the world and also cares deeply about all people of the world. And so not just an us versus them thing. So I don't know if that is a helpful review, but it feels like that's sort of where we've gone. Anything that I said?
I do want to say that one of the reasons I've been super cagey about, or I've tried to be super cagey about what I actually believe politically, is because I do think that people identify so strongly with these parties that if I'm not aligned with them,
it will kind of disqualify me as a pastoral voice in their life. And so I'm just much more interested in our students' formation as children of God. And I think that that will have wonderful outworkings in their political actions if they just take that seriously. And so I don't really want to form them politically. I want to help them grow as whole humans, you know, emotionally and intellectually and spiritually. And I also think that conversations about politics are only really useful when both people are for the other one. And so there's a sense in which I don't even feel like my opinions about politics are useful unless the relationship is strong enough that we trust each other to change our minds.
Yeah, I'm grateful for the conversation. And I do find this stuff really hard to think about and really hard to know actually what to do. And so thanks both of you for diving into the conversation with me. And if it's agreeable, I thought maybe we might move on to a little quarantine corner.
Let's do it.
All right. So I think we need a sponsor for Quarantine Corner. I think Lysol or Zoom or someone should step in because I think we can monetize this thing. But Quarantine Corner, you know it, but we are giving you some ideas on how to fill your quarantine time. But I'm going to go first. I'm taking the reins. My Quarantine Corner is crossword puzzles. Okay.
Nice.
There's no clever way to introduce it, except for I think people are really wanting puzzles, physical puzzles. A lot of people want physical puzzles and apparently they don't exist. No, just no one's making puzzles anymore.
Yeah, I've heard that.
But here's the deal. Like every day there's a new crossword puzzle and you can literally do this every single day. And this is one of those things where it's like, I used to only do crossword puzzles when my grandma was over because she would do them all the time and we would do them together. And I was always terrible at them. But it's also one of those things once you realize, oh, actually I'm an adult and I can do these actually whenever I want to do them, you know? And so Katie and I have been doing crossword puzzles every single night. What happened was on Katie's birthday, my mom and my grandma came and did a little social distancing hangout and they dropped off just a bundle of their newspapers crossword puzzles. So we've just been slowly going through them. And sidebar, okay, I feel like when you're married, it's very tempting to just watch TV like at every dinner time. It's like you probably had a long day. It's like, oh, let's eat some dinner, let's watch TV. Just don't do that.
Don't do that.
You know, just like, just don't get in that habit. Okay, just don't watch TV when you eat every single meal. Don't do it. And one way to prevent yourself from doing that is have some crossword puzzles and do them at dinner time. And that's what we've been doing. And so I brought my crossword puzzle and I'm going to show you how delightful this is based on just some of the hilarious things that come in a crossword puzzle. Okay, so I'm going to quiz you guys. The title of the crossword puzzle is Bring Your A Game, with A in quotations. So if you're a Jeopardy fan or a crossword puzzle user, you know that the letter A is going to be important. And this is the New York Times Sunday crossword puzzle. And so
I'm nervous.
Is like the big behemoth. And if you see something with a question mark, it means it's like a joke or a play on words. So I'm going to read a few to you. And just so you know, they start with A. The first one is 50 across. The clue is greatly dismay one of the Beatles. Got anything?
Greatly dismay one of the Beatles.
I'll give you this one, and then you'll figure out what the clue is, okay? It's appall, appall. So you greatly dismay appall, one of the Beatles, appall. It's pretty good. It's
pretty nice.
Okay, it's delightful. Okay, this one is 65 across. Times when your arch enemy shows up.
No clue.
If I told you that started with A, rivals.
Rivals, rivals.
Arrivals, arrivals. That's pretty good. This is a good one. What the anti-government activist does. So maybe it's apropos for us. 81 across. Attacks, attacks. It's good. Okay, this is my favorite one. This is my favorite one. Okay, okay, okay. 111 across. Geronimo, when his beard was just coming in, he was a patchy.
Apache.
He was Apache Apache.
These are brilliant.
Oh, man. Okay, so here's what you do. You go to the grocery store with your mask on. You just buy a copy of the SACB. It's like $2. And then you get all these puzzle games. Or you go on NewYorkTimes.com. If you go to the archives, I think there's some stuff for you
That's
there.
Fantastic.
So crossword puzzles.
That doesn't surprise me at all that you guys have started doing that.
All right, what do you got for us?
Well, my quarantine corner this week is inspired by my sister. She called me a few weeks ago and it was late at night for me and she's, I think, 4 hours ahead because she's on the East Coast right now. So it was very late at night for her. She calls me and I'm like, hey, Kay, how's it going? And she's like, I just really need to tell you about this movie I just watched. And I'm like, oh my gosh. She is like weeping on the phone.
The tears, yeah.
She said, it's the most beautiful movie I've ever seen. You need to watch it right away. And the movie is called My Life as a Zucchini, which I had actually already seen before. But
you're be kidding me.
It's a French film. It's actually titled Ma Vie de Courgette.
Of course it is.
And it's a
flex, yeah.
It's a short stop motion film that you can watch in English on Netflix about a little boy whose mom dies and he goes into a foster home. And it's about him just building relationships and learning about trust and journey transitioning from living with his mom to finding himself as an orphan and living in a foster
home. Is it uplifting?
It is uplifting. It's very sad and very heartfelt, but also very uplifting. I wouldn't send you on your way with a film that would only make you sad. There is a lot of redemption in it. So, plus, it's only like an hour long. So if you feel a little on edge about whether or not you want to watch
it, I'm in 100% based on what we established last week was my respect for a great title.
Right. My life as a zucchini. Yeah.
So what you and I could be doing is we could be telling people how to fill their Friday night or Saturday night. Start the night with a little crossword puzzle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
End the night with a little life as a zucchini.
That's right. And I will say that after last week's Quarantine Corner, mm-hmm. I did go to Target and I bought Codenames, and my family has been playing it and has been improving our time
fantastic.
Together. So these Quarantine Corners are inspiring
changing the
me.
World. Maybe Codenames
oh, that's
should
amazing.
Be our sponsor.
I have to tell you, we played Settlers of Catan last night, and we can't keep my son engaged mm-hmm. in that. He's 8. And so I made him a deal that he could be the king and I would be the consigliere. And I would just give him advice, but he would make every decision. And we lost unbelievably badly, but it was a good time. All right, my life is looking. Okay, here's mine. So I was so excited about doing a podcast because I love podcasts. That's part of actually how I motivate my exercise routine. Is there's just some podcasts that I adore. And so maybe after your Friday night, you get up on Saturday morning and you've already listened to this podcast on Friday. What would you do during your Saturday morning exercise? Well, maybe you'd like another podcast. And so I have 5 podcasts that are my favorite. And incidentally, on the topic of this podcast is I actually have a conservative economist that I trust, and I have a liberal analyst that I trust. And just to make sure that I have like sound, measured voices on both sides of most issues. But those are not what I'm recommending. I am recommending the podcast Reply All. And Reply All is a podcast about the internet. And they've actually stopped putting these out because they grew up and got bigger jobs in Gimlet Media. But go back to episode 1. And here's one of the reasons I'm pitching this. Is episode 1 is called A Stranger Says I Love You. And it was going to be one of my illustrations for my spring talk on The Prophet. Because it follows this short-lived app that didn't work very well, where you could pay a stranger to go up to anyone you wanted and give them a message. And if they agreed to give this message, they would have to give whatever message you told them. And the problem was that people would give them messages and pay them messages. And like they'd have to go into REI and tell this random person this message. And they'd look at the message and they'd be like, I'm not going to tell them that. And I just think it's such a great metaphor for the prophetic literature and position that the prophets were in, where they had to give these messages, sometimes messages of love, messages of bad news. And a stranger says, I love you. And it is beautiful and devastating. And then I would recommend just kind of working through the Reply All catalog, because these guys are goofy and interesting mm-hmm. and really, I think, have a sharp take on, you know, culture and the internet.
I love it.
I have already saved it to my library.
Wow. See, we are affecting change. I don't feel like you guys gave Apache enough credit.
Oh my gosh, it was so good.
It's excellent.
Yeah, I need to make sure.
We played a game once that was along those lines, where you had to come up with these homophones and you got points for the number of syllables. And I remember my brother-in-law, he won the game with a storm system that hits the United States from Europe in April. Which is a Near Easter Nor'easter.
Nice. I don't understand how people come up with this stuff.
I don't either. By the way, Mason pooped out an entire blueberry the other day.
That's awesome.
A full blueberry.
Was that your pull?
Yeah, that's
by the way.
By the way.
By Peter Nittler.
Yeah. All right, that is it for your pod and your staff. Stanford, I will never get tired of soaking up your wisdom and peppering you with questions. And Miriam, thank you for being my new partner in peppering
Just a little production note before we go. Since we recorded this, Stanford went back and listened to his Quarantine Corner recommendation, his Reply All episode, and he noticed there were some choice words being used and offered, and so he would like for you to know that. If you would not like to hear those words, maybe avoid the episode. Good news, everybody! Your pod and your staff is now on Apple Podcasts, which means you don't even have to wait for us to post about it. Just subscribe, and it will appear on your podcast app every Friday. And hey, if you're inclined to leave a review, it might just make our day. As always, thank you to Josh Paskey and Kyle Jung, who created the music for your pod and your staff. We love it. And I will say again that we want your questions about anything and everything, so send any questions to pnittler@fbcdavis.org. And finally, our dearest college life, we love you more than the pain that you felt when we got second place in IM football. We'll get them next year, and we'll see you next week.